Good evening, you guys.
I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey.
And along with John, WB2,
KC2WGB. John and Dick attempt to run something called the Technical Net. It's a gathering of amateur radio operators most Sunday evenings for the last 29 years, let me think now, 1982. Yeah, 29 and a half years it's been going on. And apparently enough people are getting enough information out of it to continue doing it. Primarily educational. The hardware that we use as ham radio operators is reasonably complicated. Not very many people in the general population, even some of the engineers, have only partial understanding of what really goes on inside of a receiver, a transmitter, a transmission line. And by the way, I've had a humbling experience over the last couple of weeks. George, WB2IKT, re-brought to my attention. I've seen it once before, and I had completely forgotten about it, the fact that a transmission line, when you go down to the numbers like 15 kilohertz, doesn't have the same impedance anymore. And possibly we'll be discussing that tonight. There's a beautiful article by the Belden Company explaining that, and George brought that to our attention. One of the things you're going to notice on the Technical Net for the last month or so is that some disruptive activities are taking place. I'm guessing as to what's taking place is that there is an individual out there who has a lot of time on his hands, and he's unhappy. And he hears other people conducting their ham radio operation and enjoying themselves. He's unhappy, they're happy, the contrast bothers him. He feels that if he disrupts their happy activities, that he will be happier. It's a sad situation. We shouldn't be mad at him, we should feel sad for him. You're going to be hearing disruptive information. I'm almost positive of that. Let me drop. And now you've got three, as I said last week, you've got three choices. You can get angry, curse at him, which is what we shouldn't be doing, because we should feel sorry for him. And you can turn off the rig and go away. That's essentially a response number one, anger and get away from it. Number two, you can decide that with John and Dick listening on the input, we can usually hear the question and therefore repeat it over the air by various means, and so the TechNet takes place, but a little bit more slowly. The third choice is that you could say, gee, the fact that it's taking place more slowly, I don't like that. What I'm going to do instead is wait until it's filed onto the website, amateurradio.tangovictor, which will be there in a day or two, and sometimes 3 days, sometimes one day. And I can listen to the TechNet and fast forward through the portions that have the disruptive activity. So you got three choices. And so we intend to continue. The individual, I'm sure he intends to continue. He thinks he's making progress of some kind. It's a sad situation. So try to understand the psychology of what's taking place from my point of view. Usually a person is not much bigger than the thing that makes him angry. That to me is an interesting thought. It's got some merit to it, if you know what I mean. There's a lot of brain power in the New York City area. We try to tap into that, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, and that's what the TechNet does. Quite often people will be signing in from the outer areas by way of Echolink and IRLT. And so, let me drop. When you hear the beep, you should, by the way, almost one-third of the guys who sign into the TechNet get so excited when they finally get their chance to talk that they wait not at all. They as soon as I let go of the button, they're already talking, if you know what I mean. You really should wait for the beep and 1 or 2 seconds beyond the beep to make sure the whole system gets properly reset. Okay, I think you... what we intend to do tonight is have the usual check-in of people who do have a question or a comment. They're going to give John and Dick their call letters, their name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or comment. That will be followed by John giving us his mailbag responses. In other words, the guys who don't yet have a ham license and don't have a direct voice on the TechNet, which is primarily a live give and take, if you know what I mean. The majority of what the TechNet is not a written consulting service, with the exception of the brand new amateurs. So live consulting, live vocal back and forth information is what it primarily consists of. So John will give us a few of his mailbag responses. That will be followed by Paul, WS2N, who is our space expert, who will tell us if anything interesting has been happening with NASA. If you happen to watch 60 Minutes tonight, you saw a beautiful presentation about what's taking place in Brevard County, I think it is, in Florida, the county that contains the Kennedy Space Center. That county is really going through some hard times now that the space shuttle was canceled, and the thing that was supposed to follow up from the space shuttle, that got canceled. So right now the United States has essentially no major launch capability like the shuttle. And so we have to buy rides on vehicles, on other people, and eventually there's going to be a number of private concerns that are trying to fill the gap of a supplying launch. So quite possibly Paul will be telling you something about that. Okay, now I'm going to take check-ins. Please give me your call at a scene. Try not to talk on top of each other. We'll get you all. Don't worry. And a typical sign-in would sound like this, WB2IKT, George, and yes. So do we have any check-ins? Give me a call, letter, name, and that word yes right now. K2LIW.
RSO, Frank, yes.
KGB, how is my big boyfriend?
And to XGN, after this space report.
Okay, we got Wesley and Frank. Frank, that was W2RSO. Do I have your call letters correctly, Frank?
It's Wesley, WGB.
Almost. It's N2RSO, November 2.
We got you, Frank. Okay, we got Frank and Wes. Anyone else check in? Give me your call letters and name and the word yes right now.
N2MB and yes. Good evening, Dick.
My ass.
Very fine, Barry. Okay. Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name.
Paul with the space report. Good evening.
Okay, Paul's going to have a space report. Who else? Who doubled with Paul?
Hang on.
Okay, well, so far we've got Frank, Barry, and Paul, and Wes. Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name right now. Okay, maybe more people will sign in later. Frank, into RSO. What's going on in your neighborhood? I think you live in Brooklyn. I believe you're a part of the Kings County Radio Club, but I might have you confused with someone else. You got it, Frank.
Okay, Dick, close but no cigar. I live in Wantua, and member of LIMAR, and past president of the Wantua Amateur Radio Club. My question tonight, more or less a comment, and I'm trying to see what the feelings of the people listening tonight are on this particular subject, and it involves earthquakes. I ran across a couple of articles on the internet where some scientists now theorize that earthquakes and subsequently tsunamis are being caused, believe it or not, by the constant drilling into the Earth's core for oil and for natural gas. All this drilling is causing pockets or voids within the crust of the Earth, and therefore causing movement of the tectonic plates. And this is one of the reasons why we're having so many earthquakes lately. I was curious to know what you think about that, Dick, and also any comments from our listeners. Back to Ned and to RSO.
Yeah, darn interesting question, Frank. And I think the answer is both yes and no. I'm going to give my answer and then throw it over to the group to find out what they feel. In the case of the major tectonic plates that are moving, that consists of thousands of miles of diameter of chunks of the Earth's crust, for mankind to think that he's affecting something that big is a little bit extravagant as I see it. I just don't think so. Also, when you look at the geologic records, for thousands and thousands of years, there have been major earthquakes and lots of evidence of that. So it's been going on long before mankind had anything to do with it. So when it comes to really major areas like the San Andreas Fault in California, or the great big one that took place in Fukushima, Japan, really major plates that have been moving for lots and lots of millions of years, I don't think mankind is affecting it very much. Yes, without a doubt, there has been some evidence of minor quakes being aggravated by chunks of land that previously were biased for earthquake along the San Andreas Fault, where you're getting minor quakes every month, so to speak, and when pressurized fluids are injected underground in order to do mining operations, yes, you are aggravating those individual areas, and some minor quakes, I think, are being aggravated, caused, whatever, minor ones. But when it comes to the really big ones, where a chunk of plate has been subducting for a couple of hundred years and it finally lets loose, like took place in Japan last year, I don't think mankind has had very much to do with it. So are we affecting it? Yeah. By the same token, the global warming situation, is mankind affecting it? Without a doubt. But are we the major effect? There's been all kinds of heating and cooling cycles throughout Earth's history, and we seem to be aggravating this particular one. We're accelerating it. But it would, to some degree, it would take place even without us. These are some of my opinions. Now, you guys who do a lot more reading than I do, I'm sure you've got some opinions, so give me your call letters right now. KQRIW in the TechNet. Hey, Dick. I think that was Dave with a quick, hey, Dick. Was that you, Dave?
N2MB, I'm there.
That was N2FLF, I'm sorry. N2FLF is what it sounded like. We're going to take you and Barry in that order. FLF, so go ahead.
Hey, I have a friend who I've known since like 1968. He became an atmospheric scientist. If you can give me an email address, I guess I can look online and find one for you. I'll send you an email he sent to me about global warming.
Okay, when it comes to your general opinion of that thing that you've read that you're about to send to me, and by the way, my call letters at arrl.net will give something to me rather easily. When it comes to the article you're talking about, what's your first impression? What do you think it was saying, Frank? Go ahead.
It's Mark. Yeah. I really don't believe in the whole global warming nonsense. It's all political and it's about money. Billions and billions and billions of dollars. I'll email you this letter, and you read it. It's only about a page long, and it's written so I can understand it. So anybody can. It's quite informative. It's quite informative. And it might change your mind. It might not. I don't know.
Do you feel that mankind is having no effect at all on the local global warming situation? In other words, do you believe that the warming that NASA has got significant evidence of, when they look at the ice melting at the poles, among other places, do you believe that that's purely Mother Nature, and that mankind, with the increase in carbon dioxide that's definitely being measured in the atmosphere, which is a greenhouse gas, do you believe mankind is not doing it, that what global warming we're seeing is purely Mother Nature? Is that what you're saying, Mark? Go ahead.
I would have to say pretty much right. It's Mother Nature. If we are doing anything, it's such a ridiculously small amount that it doesn't matter. But I'll send you an email in a few minutes, and, it shouldn't take you long to read. And it might explain some things, which you don't really hear on the radio. You know, broadcast radio.
One further question to you, though, Frank. When you plot the amount of carbon dioxide in parts per million in the atmosphere over the last 50 years, and you look at that curve and that trend, do you believe that that's also Mother Nature, or do you believe that mankind did partially create that one? Over to you, Mark.
Pretty much, I think it's mostly Mother Nature.
Okay, it's an unusual coincidence that just as we start using a lot of fossil fuel, and you look at the rate of fossil fuel consumption and the rate of increase of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, they just happen to correlate very, very well. That's one hell of a coincidence over the last 100 years. So you can see I've got a little bit of a bias on that one. But Barry, N2MB, those guys in Far Rockaway, they know where it's at. Barry, tell us what you think is going on here. N2MB, KQRIW.
In case you too, like you, the comment that you can fit me in.
And then Bruce,
yeah. Glenn and Wesley also. Go ahead, Barry.
Okay, real good. Well, actually, my comment wasn't about global warming, but I'll comment on it anyway. I tend to think that we are accelerating global warming. That's my opinion. Anyway, back to this, my question. Not my question, but another comment. The earthquake thing you were discussing a moment ago. I think that the minor earthquakes we're having, where they're doing the drilling, actually might be a good thing, because they're releasing this seismic activity in small amounts, rather than to let it build up and, you know, a big bang. So it may actually be advantageous to do this drilling. That's my comment on that one. So I think the slipping, actually by lubricating or whatever the hell they're doing, by pumping water into the ground, whatever they're doing, is making it slip slowly, which is a good thing. Anyway, that wasn't my comment. So we're going to get to my question later. I don't want to take up time with my question now. That was, my question has something to do with something else. Back to net control and 2MB.
Very fine, Barry. And I like what you're saying on that one, that we could be relieving the stresses. The one thing I worry about with the fracking process, as it's called, is that some of the chemistry is not being well-defined. It could be carcinogenic. In some cases, if it's not done carefully, the chemistry being pumped underground ends up as part of the water supply. And so that could have other effects. And is that being properly monitored? And is there enough regulation on that one? Is an interesting question. But relieving the stress, I like that one. Very similar to what some guys do on radio towers, where they put sharp, vertical, spiky objects to try to relieve the charge buildup that could, in many cases, become a lightning strike. There are many who believe that a lightning arrestor on a tower is quite effective and quite often will lower the magnitude and the number of lightning strikes. When Mother Nature really wants to strike a particular structure, she's going to do it no matter what you do, but some of the more minor cases, I think you can cut that one down. Okay, Wes and Glenn in that order. Now, Wes, what do you think is on this this particular subject that was brought up that was Frank, into RSO, who brought up the question on the earthquakes. You got it, Wes, K2RIW.
The thing is that Saudi Arabia is pumping more and more oil. They create a cavity and then try to fill up that cavity. They do it with the high pressure pump. They try to do it with water. They don't have much water. They try to eventually use any kind of chemicals trying to get those cavities closed. When the cavity remains open, they are more and more vulnerable for the earthquake or whatever tectonic cavity that appears in this area. They also treat them with heated steam to mobilize deposits. They use the progressive cavity pumps to bring the oil. All of this is not only in Saudi Arabia, but it's in Venezuela. The same problem. Now, the United States Geophysical found that the tectonic activity or the seismic activity, I'm sorry, in both of these regions increased rapidly for the past 20 years, and they keep increasing. So, one of the very significant things that I have seen on YouTube was a sound fountain. Was a huge one and was caused by the natural gas that found its way and was actually causing a huge blow of the sound. More and more scientists think that Saudi Arabia is getting closer to the self-created problems of the big magnitude. They try to cover all of the things that happen over there, but it's about 20% this year, only this year, 20% more activity, seismic activity, than it was in the two past years before, and to Asia.
And do you have any idea of the approximate size of the seismic activity? Are we talking about a Richter 5 earthquake in Saudi Arabia, which I think you're saying might be being caused by all of the oil pumping? What size of seismic activity are we talking about in the West? Go ahead.
It's a good question. I have this material somewhere. I couldn't find it. But we're talking about a seismic activity that brings that region close to the Yellow Park, Yellowstone, and to Adria.
Okay, we'll find out some more about that. Glenn, what's your feeling on this one? KC2QIQ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Hey, good evening, Vic. It's an interesting topic, but I think as far as the drilling goes and depth, the drilling depth of most wells and therefore for just about all the kind of energy mining that's being done, whether it's drilling, going for coal, going for natural gas, depth really doesn't have the impact as there was a shift in a continental plate. So I would say that maybe there's some kind of possibly a fifth order effect that might cause some vibrations. Other evidence is too is that if you look at where most of the drilling takes place as opposed to where the earthquake zones are really located right where the plates are located. Most oil rigs and things like that are actually located pretty far away from those kinds of locations. So, there's no direct proportion between seismic activity and drilling for energy. Let's drop for a second. My second feeling on the global warming stuff is that I don't think the global warming has really ever been an issue, but I can't say this much as far as our atmosphere is concerned. I like the air we breathe. Here on Long Island, we may not have the cleanest air, but I have to tell you, you go to some other countries, like in Asia right now, the air is really, really bad. You get off a plane over there, you want a gas mask. And, keeping the air clean, I think, is really just a very, very vital thing. Same thing with our water and everything else. As far as, global warming, I don't know about that, but you go to other countries where they don't have the control and keep the atmosphere clean, really begin to appreciate what, has really been done in terms of environmental laws here in the United States over the last 20 or 30 years. But back to you, K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Quick comment, Vic, and to FLS. We'll get you in a second, Mark. I like what you're saying, Glenn. The main point you're bringing is that many of the seismic activities are taking place from numbers like 5, 10 miles below the surface of the Earth, and very rarely does drilling go down quite that far. So we don't go far enough to really be affecting the exact mass center, so to speak, of the subduction zone relaxation of these kind of a major quake like we had in Japan fairly recently. I have another comment with reference to global warming. So, as you can tell, of the opinion that the carbon dioxide we're putting in the air, I think, is aggravating it. RSO, go ahead, Frank, you want to make... What, was it FLS? Mark, go ahead, Mark, KQRIW. Mark, do you have your PL turned on? Because your last comment did not come through the repeater. Go ahead.
How am I doing now, Vic?
Now you're coming through beautifully, so please repeat that last comment. I heard it very nicely on the input, but it didn't come through the repeater. Go right ahead, Mark.
Okay, sorry about that. Yes, I said it. You had gotten the email. You should get it when you click get. At the very bottom, I sent you a link, which will take you to a page from Newsweek, April 28, 1975. Which they were worried about global cooling. Interesting.
Yeah, but 1975 is 35 years ago. Things have changed a lot in 35 years. Gee, way back then, I think I was buying gasoline for 35 cents a gallon or something like that. What would I like to be able to do that again, Mark? So as I see it, Frank, you've asked a rather interesting question. There's no exact answer, but it's a good thing to speculate about. As I look at... QIZ.com on you, I see that you and I were born in very close to the same time period, so we are almost contemporaries. Back to you, Frank. N2RSO, the guy who asked the original question, K2RIW.
K2, Jack. One more comment. BGB, we're coming.
Okay, we're going to go to Eric West and John in that order, but Frank first. I turn it to Frank and let Frank say a few words. Go ahead, Frank.
Okay, Dick. Thank you for your comments and comments from others. And I'm going to yield the mic over to the other people with additional comments. By the way, I have to secure from the net for a while. I've got a landline call here. Thank you again. Have a nice evening and 2 hours. So.
Very fine, Frank. We'll let you go. As if we had a choice. Eric, K2EJ, you got an opinion on global warming and plate tectonics? K2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2J. I'm going to translate it right down. I don't know if you guys remember in high school, there used to be a Bell Lab series, science and technology series. You go to YouTube and do a search for 1958 global warming, you will find a clip of a film with, which was actually written and directed by Frank Capra, and it had Dr. Frank Baxter, if you remember, and an actor by the name of Richard Colson, and Sterling Holloway. They did shows like Hemo to Magnificent. Actually, the one about global warming was called the, trying to think of the name of it, the Unchained Goddess was the name of it. And if you do a YouTube search for it, this was 1958, talking about sticking all that carbon dioxide in the air. K2RIW, K2J.
K2R.
Okay, Bernie's on the list. Very good, Eric. So it's been around a while. And I do remember way back in the 70s, late 60s and early 70s, people were concerned about global warming then and the rate of buildup of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, which is a greenhouse gas. In other words, the sun shines through, the carbon dioxide turns into infrared heat light when it hits the Earth, and the infrared energy doesn't get back through the carbon dioxide very well. So we do get a greenhouse effect from it. Let's see, the next person on the list was Wes. Go right ahead, Wes.
Just a quick comment on the Unchained Goddess.
Yeah, go ahead, Bernie.
No, I was just going to comment and brag a little bit. If you watch that movie, they show hurricane hunters out of Bermuda. When they show the pilot of the airplane, that's my father.
Give us a couple more words on that, Bernie. Very interesting. I think you're talking about a 1965 movie, and that was your father. Go right ahead.
It's an interesting, it's a science film that they showed all throughout the, let's say in the 70s, it was a standard film you watched in school, in junior high. And I'm sitting in class one day, half paying attention, they're showing this weather movie, and they talk about hurricane hunters. I knew that my father was a hurricane hunter out of Bermuda during the Korean War. And all of a sudden they show a picture, and I go, wait a minute, that's my dad. So I go home to dinner that night, we're all around the dinner table, I said, Dad, I saw you in a movie in science class today. My father starts to laugh and says, yeah, I do remember that. A film crew came down and shot pictures of us, but the producer was afraid to fly, so they're sitting on the tarmac in a B-29 bomber with somebody with a fire hose hosing down the windshield so it looks like they're up in the air, and they're bouncing around in their seats to simulate turbulence.
Oh-ho. Now, you're telling me B-29s were used for hurricane hunting then. I guess the P-3C Orion hadn't been used yet, which I think is the major aircraft being used for hurricane hunting today. Is that approximately true, Bernie? Go ahead.
Oh, absolutely. We're talking 1951, 52. So the B-29 was the only thing they had to get up that high that was pressurized so that it crews up high enough to get inside the hurricane.
Very good. Okay, I think the next person on the list is going to be Wes and John in that order. Go ahead, Wes.
Just a quick comment on the earthquakes in region of Asia. The earthquake that happened in this area is the sudden release of the energy in the Earth crust that creates the seismic waves because of the cavities that exist over there. So when the plates rub against each other to create the waves of energy, then come to the Earth's surface, that causes the tremors that we call the earthquake. But it must be the right condition for it. So the magnitude of this earthquake increase because the more and more oil is pumped from that area. Now, sometimes a methane is trying to take, which is usually associated with an oil deposit over there, take place of it. That, due to the temperature that is created there through, because when you remove the oil, and then methane is trying to take the place, and at the same time, you put the steam, hot steam, to activate the deposit. Now you are pre-causing a natural disaster. When a small earthquake happens in this area at that particular time, the methane that is there with the high vapor of water that is in the form of steam is trying to explode. Of course, Saudis, they are happy because then they have a rapid increase of the pressure of the deposit to the pump. But that created numerous times already the destruction of the on-the-earth the piping structure. So it looks like they have, I found in the articles, they had started to have a problem in 1973, then 1976, 1977, 1993, 1997. And the magnitude of the ringing was 3.2 to 4.8 of the Richter, and right now just this year for the 3 months of this year they've got 20% of the increased activity comparing to the last 2 years. Just for the 3 months. So it looks like scientists are very worried about a creation of natural disaster of big magnitude in this region. And to exit.
Interesting. Something to keep an eye on. I'm going to go over to John next for his comment, and after that I'm going to go back to Glenn, because I'd like to hear which country in Asia Glenn was in when he sensed rather unclean air. But John first, KC2WGB, go right ahead, John. K2RIW on the deck, man.
Good evening, Dick. KC2WGB. Well, Dick, there's a set of books, several volumes, and they're labeled Gas Lift Theory and Practice. If you read those books, you will find that fracking has been going on for many, many years. It's not something new. Originally, back in the days of Rockefeller, when we drilled a well, they relied on the pressure to bring up the product. Then someone devised ways, depending on whether it was sweet crude or standard, they would either pump ice or water or steam down into the thing to cause the pressure to have it come up. Because you can't just suck it up with a pump. So that fracking business has been going on a long time, and we've been doing it all over America. So I doubt very much if that really has anything to do with earthquakes. And if anything, maybe minor ones locally. But don't forget, they're filling those with water to get the pressure on and the energy needed to make the lift of either the gas or the oil. So it's constantly being replaced. So they're not leaving it in the cavity, such as a mine would do. Just something to think about. And as far as global warming, 400 years ago we had a mini ice age. It's going to happen again. So we're going through cycles. Yeah, we're creating a little bit of warming. Maybe we're accelerating it. We're at the zenith curve, maybe. And we may push it over the edge sooner, but I think it's going to happen anyway. It's just a normal cycle of how the Earth functions. Back to you, Dick.
You brought up an extremely interesting point. We all forget about the fact that if I wanted to pump water by sucking on a pipe, so to speak, the air pressure will not give you a height of water beyond 29 and a fraction feet, 30 feet, something in that order, 32 feet. Yes, you do have a little excess pressure underground, but until you really force that oil up the, have enough pressure to force it up the whole, let's call it half a mile of pipe, it ain't gonna come out the other end unless you've got some kind of a rod that goes all the way down there and there's some kind of a piston pump at the bottom. I think a few of the oil wells operate on a somewhat similar principle. But to put a submersible pump below ground and have it survive all the sand and everything else that's going to come through it, that's that. And to replace that pump periodically by holding out all of that pipe, wow. So I can see that not a great deal of pumping below ground takes place is a good guess on my part. I may be wrong on that one. Glenn, I'm going to turn it back over to you. I could use a little bit more audio, Glenn. Your audio was a little bit on the low side. But what country were you in how long ago when you sensed what you felt was a rather unhealthy air compared to Long Island? KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the second half.
Well, I can just give you an idea. Back in 91, 92, when I was in Europe, basically in the Munich area, in Germany, they have a circle, right, a series of circles of roads that go that get closer and closer to the city. I used to think that, well, the air in Manhattan was not that great. Well, let me tell you something. The air in Manhattan was like a spring forest compared to Munich. When you start getting closer to the center of that city, just the thickness and the density of the smelly rotten air was horrible. And it hasn't gotten better since. And then, you know, the other areas that I'm talking about are in China, and which is, you know, just over the last few years. Shenzhen, well, first you have Taiwan. Taiwan, the air is pretty nasty. Hong Kong, the area is pretty nasty. And just over the bay areas between Hong Kong and or Taiwan to the mainland, a lot of industrial areas along the coast over there. And I mean, there is just some of those towns. It's just so thick you can cut it with a knife. Like, it's awful. Sorry, that you case you could join.
Just quick comment. The first earthquake ever was recorded in Kuwait in 1931. Since 1997, the National Seismic Network of Kuwait recorded 300 local earthquakes. That happened from March 1997 to December 2006.
Interesting. Glenn, do you believe in those cities that you're discussing? China, Hong Kong, Taiwan, and the German city. Is it the smokestack industry nearby that you think is the major cause of evasion? Back to you, Glenn.
I think it's just a little bit of everything. It all adds up. You know, if you don't have regulations on the power plants, you don't have regulations on the automobiles, you don't have regulations on just that everything. Eventually it all adds up. You know, you have to realize, like, over the last 35 years, we've done a lot to the cars to cut back the emissions. We've done a lot to, just about everything. You know, we've cut back the emissions a lot. I mean, I don't know if you can remember, Dick. I'm sure that you can. But back in the 70s, I remember, when I was in school at that time, the side of a parkway, grass didn't grow there. it was always brown. You know, today, they really have to do a lot of trimming along the sides of the parkways and highways now because the grass can grow from the emissions just from the automobiles alone. Back to you, Ben.
T2OIS with a comment.
And then to HGM.
Dick, just one more quick thing. Do you remember how your eyes used to burn just by standing in the back of a car? You know, do you ever find a car that was made like pre-60s? And it was just idle there for a while, your eyes would just tear and burn, especially if you were in traffic on a highway.
I think you're right, and I wonder, was that the tetraethyl lead and other things that were put into the gas at those times, in the fuel of those times? KC2OYS, butter's your name, sir, and your comment.
Yes, KC2OYS is Mark. Comment is, first of all, I don't believe in the climate change, not global warming anymore, it's called climate change. And as we know, Al Gore has a carbon credit scheme going on.
company called Carbon War, and they trade carbon credits on the Chicago Exchange. And this is a scheme to suck us out of dough. When you go back in years, when there was more carbon on Earth, plants grew, plenty of food, no problem. Well, once you start putting aluminum oxide in the air, you're blocking the sun from coming through. Let me let it drop. And in doing so, not only is it stopping the sun from coming through, okay, and helping us get our vitamin D that we need, and the plants getting the carbon dioxide to grow so we can have food and also breathe the air. So if you really want to commit suicide, cut out all the carbon dioxide. Over to you, Dick.
I think I have something interesting for you guys, which regards radio devices. One of the things is that recorded earthquake in Kuwait revealed that earthquake activity in Kuwait is concentrated mainly in two regions. One is Guadiyar, which is the oil field, and the other one is Al Rudahain, which is the oil field. The tectonic shifts are characterized by the low magnitude, which is 4.5, and the shallow depth of 30 kilometers. They made the investigation. It indicates that some of this earthquake has occurred as a result of oil production activity. Now, we're talking about 300 earthquakes, and the first one ever happened was in 1931. And what did they do? Well, they use a device. It's a recording device, digitizing using, that amplifies and digitizes the record of observed data. Refraction technology, which is 72A-07, data acquisition system I'm reading right now, has three channels, 24-bit digitized recorder and internal RAM that provides 512 buffer to the data retention, allowing adequate storage for packets to be retransmitted. This unit is a narrow-band transmitter with a frequency selectable from 381 to 391 megahertz band. The radiator power is maximum 4 watts. The Monitron, M-O-N-I-T-R-O-N, model R435F, is the matching receiver with the same frequency, 381 to 391 megahertz. The antenna employed is the Yagi antenna with 12 dB gain. The antenna is mounted vertically polarized to maximize interference. Kuwait National Seismic Network is the real-time telemetric full-duplex seismic network. The stations are powered by the batteries, which are charged through the solar cells to supply continuous power. That's what I was able to read so far. This is a kind of seismometer that works in Kuwait. But it is scary. It is scary. 1997, 2006, 300 local earthquakes because of the oil cavity. Now the same story is noticeable in Saudi Arabia, Arab Emirates, and in Venezuela and to Asia.
1997.
Yeah, the UHF frequencies you're talking about being used to transmit the seismic information back reminds me a little bit of some of the similar UHF frequencies. VHF, UHF frequencies are being used in the oil field in New Jersey to control valves and send pieces of telemetry data. And I have something to do with the design of some of those antennas. About the only way I can think that in Saudi Arabia and Kuwait that they're running into earthquakes as a function of their petroleum operations would seem to be, from what we're hearing up till now, if they're not doing the proper amount of replacement. In other words, if they are really leaving a cavity or creating either overpressure or underpressure by not doing the replacement at the same rate that they're doing extraction. We may eventually find out about that. The next person on our list with a real question was Barry, N2 Moonbounce. And I wonder if you're as surprised as I am, Barry, that when you go down to numbers like 50 kilohertz and below, your coax cable and your twin lead don't have anywhere near the same impedance anymore. The impedance starts climbing real fast. I was brought to my attention once a few years ago, and now George has re-brought it to our attention, and it's something that we don't even think about. However, as I see it, we had a little bit of a clue. You and I, from time to time, Barry, have used a piece of flexible coax cable where we wanted real good shielding from, say, for instance, a 60-cycle magnetic field. And we rapidly discovered that the shield on the coaxial cable, down at a frequency as low as 60 hertz, does a fairly poor job. Until you get to new metal and other things like that, you don't really shield the magnetic field from being picked up by that center conductor. So that's another hint that the depth of penetration at
repeater,
big fucking.
That's another example that the depth of penetration at those very low frequencies is exceeding the thickness of the braid on the cable. Therefore, we're not getting very much shielding. I think that depth of penetration, I am speculating, is a factor as to why the impedance starts climbing. But I know this is not your question. I just thought I'd throw it in while I got a little bit of time. Go right ahead with your real question, Barry. N2MB, K2RIW.
Okay. Yeah, actually, I had some, not on that subject, but I actually did have something on that subject. I was involved in putting seismic sensors along a pipeline in Africa many years ago, and we were surprised to find out how much the earth was shaking in Africa, and nobody ever knew about it until we put the seismic sensors in. We were doing this for a completely different reason. They were cutting the pipes to steal the oil, so we wanted these sensors so that when they start cutting the pipes, we would know about it. Anyway, I just have a comment. I've been doing extensive work on my antenna system in the last 10-15 days. I put up a big 6-meter beam. I took down a lot of antennas and rebuilt them and put them up. One of the antennas that I rebuilt and put up, you should know about it. It's called the RW19. And I just want to comment. You don't sell them anymore, so it doesn't matter. We're not making a bid here for people to buy them. But I got to tell you, of all the antennas I took down, the 19, the RW19, I didn't have to do anything to. It was perfect as the day I put it up. That's amazing. And I got it back up tonight, actually today. I put it up today, back up. All I did was just scrape some of the gook off of it and put a new feed line on it because the feed line was getting leaky. And I'm hearing the beacons down in Philadelphia just as good as I ever did. Absolutely amazing. That's a testimonial, Dick. And I know you don't sell them, so there's nothing to be gained. We're not making a pitch here. K2RW and 2MB.
Interesting information, Barry. And you live in a very tough environment. You live essentially right on the Atlantic Ocean. Those sea breezes that blow over your land 90% of the time. So any dissimilar metals on antennas, anything that's going to build up corrosion, you're going to get it. I know that I think there was a time when you once made a gusset plate out of 2024 T3 aluminum, which is one that doesn't have anywhere near the corrosion resistance of 6061 T6 alloy, and I believe it started peeling off in like sheets of mica. When it comes to the materials that were in the RIW-19 Yagi, which was invented, let me think now, 1978 for the antenna game competition of the East Coast VHF Society in New Jersey. The original antenna, let me drop.
Nagger!
The original antenna was made with plastic blocks holding the elements above the boom. Those plastic blocks were held on the boom with aluminum pop rivets. And I guarantee that combination wouldn't have had anywhere near the longevity of the final design. The mechanics of that design was done by a genius named George Flanagan, W2 Kilo Romeo Mike, K2 W2KRM. He's a real fancy mechanical engineer who came up with the idea of those Gelrin shoulder bushings and the kind of star washers that you push on that hold things together. That whole mechanical layout and the way the driven element assembly is made. I made a folded dipole driven element assembly fed with semi-rigid coax cable, but he did the mechanical engineering that's really making it have some longevity. So George is the guy that we should be tapping on the shoulder. On the back. The front cover of QST magazine about a year ago had a version of the RIW 19 Yagi done by League headquarters, where they're making a four or a six element Yagi, as I remember, on 432 for field day like operations and for 10 gig field operations. And that was being done by why can't I think of Zach call letters right now?
Yeah, I believe M squared is using this similar design to what you did.
Shut up.
Yeah, that makes some sense. And let's see, W1VT, I think, is now the call letters of KH6 something or other. That was Stan. No, this is Zach. You know the guy from headquarters. What's his name? Why can't I think of it? I think Zach is the first name.
Yeah, I don't remember.
How quick you and I forget people's names. Anyhow, on the front cover of QST, you see him assembling one of those antennas with insulated elements. The real, quote, breakthrough in some people's minds was the fact that when you have more than about five elements on a Yagi, and the elements go through the boom, and outdoors aluminum oxide will build up, so in very short order, the elements no longer make contact to the boom, which changes their electrical length. So very slowly your antenna is changing in electrical length, your Yagi is being detuned, and you don't even know about it. By insulating the elements from the boom, you essentially eliminate that problem. That was the main thrust of that design, as well as a very carefully tuned design with a ratiometry antenna range. And that you can read about in February 1976, I think it was, QST Magazine. The ratiometry antenna range, which is an article that I wrote. And it's interesting to see that one of the world's best antenna ranges is the one held at the Rome Air Development Center near Utica, New York, and they are using a ratiometry antenna range. And did they get the idea from my article, or did they get the idea independently? Interesting question. We'll never know. But I've done some work up there, and I wasn't smart enough to ask them that question. Although, even if they did, the people up there who set up that particular range had done it so many generations ago, so to speak, that I probably wouldn't even be able to easily find out. Okay, thank you for the information, Barry. And one other thing I want to tell you, Barry.
Yeah, fuck.
And that is, now that you've got, I think it's a 50-foot-long boom Yagi on 6 meters, tell me what you're hearing with that. That is one piece of work. If I know you, you've got that 75 feet or more above the ground, a 50-foot-long boom Yagi on 6 meters. I'll bet that thing can sing. Tell us what you've heard so far at first light, if you know what I mean. N2 Moonbounds, K2RIW.
And he's a fat anyway.
Okay. Yeah, actually, I know this is going to come as a shock to everybody, but I'm not terribly impressed yet. I had a few problems when I put it up. It wasn't the antenna. It was the fact that I had another 6-meter beam on the tower, and I wanted to leave it there so that I could compare results between the two antennas. But as it turned out, the other antenna was affecting the M squared so much that I had to remove it. I couldn't do anything with it. It was really devastating the M squared. So I had to remove it. Once I did that, the M squared started to work just fine. All the problems were gone. But the thing is, I use a beacon in Philadelphia, the Packrat beacon. I think it's 0.3 watt into three halos stacked one above the other. That's what they're using. So it's a pretty weak, signal here in New York most of the time. And I'm trying to compare it. Unfortunately, I can't make a direct comparison. I'm trying to compare it to the old antenna that I had. It was a five-element Cushcraft. And
I'm thinking there isn't a hell of a lot of difference. It might be a little better, but you know something? It's not like, you know, the pattern is a little better, but I don't notice any big advantage. I don't notice the beacon coming in much louder. It's just not like that. And I'll tell you, when I put up the RW19, I compared that to another antenna I had, and the RW19 is head and shoulders better than the other antenna. Of course, this is 19 elements. The other one was about, I think, 11 or 12, something like that. So you have...
Repeater, time out.
Now, we did lose the last 20 seconds of what you're saying, Barry, but I heard you very nicely on the input. When it comes to the effective capture area of individual Yagi's, how closely you can stack them, they can be stacked amazingly close. Even the elements mounted on the exact same boom, if the individual Yagi's are on different frequencies, or when they're on the same frequency, now you've got to calculate the real capture area. The capture area, I haven't done the calculation, but I'm going to do, on your 50, on your 6-meter, very long boom Yagi, might be something like a 25-foot diameter circle, might even be bigger. So if the other Yagi was not at least that distance away, yes, you're going to get a lot of overlapping of their effective areas, and therefore compromising of one of the other. A second Yagi on 6 meters, before you removed it, roughly how far away was it, Barry? N2MB, K2RIW?
I'll just talk over that. Very too close. It was like 6-7 feet away, and I should have known better.
Yeah, that stacking distance that you're allowed to use, it gets worse and worse as you go to lower and lower frequencies. It gets worse and worse as you go to a long and longer boom. And you did both. The RIW Yagi on 432 has got an effective capture area of 5.5-foot diameter circle. A good 2-meter Yagi is around 12.5 or so foot diameter circle. A 6-meter Yagi probably is a 20. Your long boom Yagi is probably a 30-foot. So it might be a 30-foot diameter circle effective capture area, and you have the second Yagi 6 feet away. With what you now know, Barry, I think you can tell you were pushing your luck a little bit on that one. And so, now, the fact that you do or don't repeat it.
I got him at a 9.
Yes, 9 in Rockaway.
5-9 plus 20 next to my house. Like he's passing next to my house.
Yeah, quite weak out here on Long Island. Barry, the fact that you get the beacon in Philadelphia, not quite as strong as you'd like to. Don't judge that too fast. You and I know that propagation from day to day can make the signal a hell of a lot stronger or a hell of a lot weaker, depending on what the local weather is like. What's the total length of time you've been using that long boom Yagi with the other one removed? I think it's only been a couple of days or maybe even less. Is that true? Over to you, Barry.
Yeah, it's only been 2 days. You're absolutely right. I was thinking about that when it was happening. Absolutely. I'm thinking that I do hear the beacon every day, and I believe with the other antenna, I could go for many, many days and not hear the beacon on 6. So I think we'll probably have an improvement, but, you know, it'll take time to tell.
KC2QIQ with a comment.
Glenn recognized a 0.3 watt, 300 milliwatt beacon on 6 meters, unless it's on an extremely high building. That's really flea power. And I guess Philadelphia, I'm going to make a guess, is a healthy, almost, 180 or so miles from you. I should know. You probably can tell me how many miles. Right after we pick up Glenn, I'm going to turn it back to Barry. He's going to tell us roughly how many miles is that beacon from his house. KC2QIQ is starting to sound a little bit louder on the audio. K2RIW, go ahead, Glenn.
This is sort of a question, you know, from just some experimentation I've done on the 6 meter band, but it's one of the few bands where I found that beams don't really seem to make a whole lot of difference. It, it,